The Talk of the Northwest, The Greg Hughes Show on Highland Radio.
Hello and a very good morning. You're very welcome along to the programme. It's fantastic to have you on board. We are on the last show of the week. Thank you very much to Donna Marie Doherty for sitting in for me yesterday. Myself and Shannon were down, as I mentioned, just to late the Law Society of Ireland. We've been shortlisted twice in the one category, which is fine. But, you know, there was a huge attendance there. We didn't quite win, but, you know, what we realised in being down there is that being shortlisted in and of itself was quite the achievement. So fair play to everyone down there. Right, now our Friday panel is going to be joining us very, very shortly. Just to remind you, we want you involved in the conversation as well. 086 60 25000 is the WhatsApp and text number, 086 60 25000. Or you can give us a call on 074 91 25000. Or if you want to email the programme, it's comments@highlandradio.com. Let's say good morning to our panel. We'll start with you, Paddy Rooney, Chair of Friends of Letterkenny University Hospital. How are you keeping? Good to have you on the programme as always. Any news? Any crack? How's life treating you?
No, very little. I'm not able to leave the house because of the heavy rain this last few days.
I know, but we're going to get a respite. We're going to get a respite tomorrow and Sunday, which is good.
Hopefully so.
All right, okay. Professor Pat O'Connor, are you there?
I'm here, but my video doesn't seem to be working, or I'm getting a message saying you have switched it off. I don't know why.
Well, we're here. It's fine. As long as I can hear your dulcet tones, we will be grand. And we have Kieran Brogan, Councillor Kieran Brogan, joining us really, really shortly. Pat, I'll start with you, if that's okay. That's Pat O'Connor, Professor Pat O'Connor, Professor of Sociology at and Social Policy Emeritus at the University of Limerick. In light of the recent unrest following the North Belfast stabbing, how can political leaders from both the North of Ireland, the Northern Ireland Executive and Westminster effectively, and of course in the Republic, de-escalate anti-immigrant sentiment while addressing the genuine security and community safety concerns raised by the public, Pat? It's a tough one.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, both sides, all groups have come out condemning the violence that has erupted in the north. I suppose I think it needs to go beyond this. Do you know, okay, there are security and policing issues are the immediate response, but it isn't a coincidence that effectively, loyalists, it seems to be largely in loyalist areas, are now, instead of sectarianism, we have racism. And so really, and this is not, of course, peculiar to the north. It exists both in here in Ireland and in the UK. So I suppose I think there needs to be a very serious reflection and discussion about masculinity, really. What we have is disaffected, largely men, who feel that they're only frequently unemployed, and the only expression of themselves is in terms of breadwinning and some concept of, quote, protecting, in inverted commas, their women, their communities. And the idea of protecting, inverted commas, it ends up with burning out buses, houses, whatever. So really, this is an issue, and there has been a lot of pussyfooting really around thinking in those terms for years, right? And I think really it's long past the time that that nettle has to be grasped.
I mean, that's an interesting way that you framed it. I mean, obviously there can be no justification or no logic really to burning out your own community or reacting in that way, but to frame it as sort of just wanton racism and predominantly male, I don't think that really hits on the concerns that are up there. It also should be noted, whilst, you know, there's a lot of vacant property, a lot of people from different backgrounds have been moved into the Protestant areas, for an example, but it's not exclusively Protestant people either. You didn't address at all the perhaps genuine concerns that people have about the movement of people in and around Ireland with sort of, you know, seemingly pure abandon.
Well, of course, there is an issue. But I mean, in a way, that issue needs to be addressed politically. It doesn't, it isn't solving the problem, actually erupting in violence. But that is what is happening. Of course, people are scared. And actually, another thing that hasn't come into sufficient focus is the dreadful lack of supports for those who are mentally ill. That is a serious problem in most, well, in our, in the north as well as here, as well as in the UK. There has been this concept of community care, and I sometimes wryly and cynically think community care means effectively it's the equivalent of pushing a wheelchair into a roundabout and waiting for the obvious to occur. That really, insofar as this does not seem, well, what evidence we have suggests that this, you know, we don't know whether this was a racist crime, but certainly the reaction has been to it as if it was a racist issue.
Well, I think the police, have said that they don't believe it to be. I'll come back to you, Pat. I do want to bring Paddy Rooney in here. Paddy, listening to, I suppose, your own reflections, and I wonder how they align with Professor O'Connor.
Yeah, I think Pat has covered it fairly well there, Greg. I mean, there is a huge responsibility on public representatives and community leaders to come out and to condemn this, but also try and coax and cajole their local communities not to do this. The problem is, though, Pat made reference there about there was across the political spectrum a condemnation of this. The problem was the condemnation from people like Matthew O'Toole of the SDLP. He was exceptionally good on this, and Claire Hanna of the SDLP in the House of Commons, and Gerry Carroll in Stormont. They covered it very well. The problem is that they don't represent the areas where all of this trouble took place, because it was predominantly, as Pat said, in North and East Belfast and pockets in Portadown. And of course, these happen to be very strong loyalist areas. I wasn't too impressed, by the way, by the way that Gavin Robinson, the leader of the DUP, talked about it while he was condemning the violence in a sort of half-hearted way. He used it as an opportunity to get a swipe at the Irish government about the fact that there wasn't an open border, and he was talking about that they should be convicted and thrown out of the country on a one-way ticket and so on. These loyalist areas down in North and East Belfast, where the trouble is, they have a long history of doing this kind of stuff, because the first time that this came to light was way, way back in 1969, and older listeners to your programme, Greg, will be familiar with the term, the two words, Bombay Street, where there was many Catholic families were burned out of North Belfast area for the simple reason that they weren't loyalists and they weren't unionists. And these areas are where the predominant the rioting took place are loyalist areas. And Pat has covered that very well. There's actually a whole flux, Greg, of other factors at play here. And all you need is some incident to take place to act as a match to set the whole thing on fire. Loyalist communities feel that they're not politically represented because parties like the PUP and them, you know, when they had a few assembly members when the Good Friday Agreement and the first assembly election in Northern Ireland after the assembly agreement, they had them, people like David Irwin and that. They don't have any representation now. And they feel that they've been left behind. They feel that they, whatever perceived benefits that they thought they were going to get out of the Good Friday Agreement and the Brexit, they didn't materialise. They now appear to have a grievance with the PSNI for no other reason than they feel that there's two-tier policing in Northern Ireland. And the other thing, which is a problem, is that they feel that the growth in both the numbers and the influence and the well-being of nationalists in Northern Ireland. I mean, it's not that long ago, Greg, that the geography or the landscape in Belfast, there was four seats in the House of Commons there, North, South, East and West Belfast, and unionists had all four of them. Now they've only one of them, and that's East Belfast. And there's a table tennis match there now between the DUP and the Alliance Party to get that seat. So if you heap all these things on top of all the things that Pat said, it is a huge problem to solve.
Because both of you have given, you know, very fine answers that are probably factually correct. But is it not the case, really, though, that we are skirting around what the critical element of all of this is. In many, many parts on this island, it's almost like a dry tinderbox or what have you. And it's based on public opinion and public concerns, whether it's justified or not. And it's always waiting for something, an event that sparks, and that goes up in flames. And the analysis both of you give there is, as I say, most likely probably perfectly accurate. But actually what this boils down to, whether or not you like how the Dublin riots happened or you dislike what's happening in Belfast, and it spread right throughout the six counties, it has to be said, the fundamental issue here is that it is tapping all from public concern about migration into this country, Pat.
There is.
Go ahead to you. Sorry, Paddy. Go ahead. Yeah, and I'll bring Pat back in.
Oh, sorry, was it Pat?
No, it doesn't matter. I'm going to go. I'll go back to Pat in a moment.
Sorry, Pat, if you don't mind. I'm
just going to work away.
I said, there are two problems here anyway, I suppose. One is the way that the governments north and south are dealing with. There's three different groups in this. There's legal migration into the country that we need. There's illegal migration that we don't need. And then there are people in IPAS centres waiting for residency. They're either fleeing war or persecution or...
That has yet to be determined. That's the third option.
The ESRI tell us that and I've said this in your programme a couple of times before, they said that the population of this country is going to increase by 100%, whatever number of years that's going to take place. But the birth rate's going down. So it's not hard to know then where the people are going to come from. They're going to come from overseas. We know they're coming from Asia, the Middle East and North Africa. That's where they're going to come from, right? Because Ireland now seems to be a destination of choice. Well, the governments both North and South would almost need to have a separate government department set up to be able to deal with this. Because where are all these people going to live? How are they going
to? But you're treating it as an inevitability.
How are they going to move around?
Yes, Paddy, you're treating this as inevitability. The thing is again, it's jumping a stage or two ahead. A lot of people aren't happy with the level of immigration. They're not happy with us signing up to the migration pact without them having a say. They don't believe it should be or is a fait accompli.
Well, a lot of people aren't unhappy because there is that, and people have they're against this anyway, no matter what's put forward for them. But the problem at the moment is, and you've said that in your programme many, many times, that a lot of the people that fall into the illegal category, and that the IPAS centre category are located in, they're concentrated in areas that are socially deprived, that have few facilities, that the people that are living there feel that they're being left behind anyway. They see people that they're getting housing in preference to them, they're getting welfare in preference to them, they're getting buggies for their children when they can't afford them themselves, and they see that there isn't a fair distribution of people throughout the country. It's very interesting to see in South Belfast, a middle-class, well-provided area in Belfast, there was nobody on the streets there. They didn't have any problem with any of this. The reason why they didn't have any problem with this, because there's no IPAS centre there, Greg.
Okay, Pat, to the question I put to Paddy, pick it up from there.
Well, I do think, yes, that he has made a crucial point, one I was about to make, that the facilities, the problem is not simply people coming from outside. It's basically the failure of facilities to keep developing. I mean, the housing issue here is a classic problem. If facilities are not provided and people feel that in the situation they can't get a doctor's appointment, they can't get a place in a creche, they can't get a house, then of course hostility is going to develop. But Patrick is also right that the birth rate is falling here. It's down to 1.4. So we will and do need people to come from outside.
Some people listening now will say, or we're not saying that people should not come in for... I just want to separate to... The listeners to this show fully understand legal migration and that people come in here and work visas and they meet and work with them every day in hospitality, in healthcare, in IT, in many other sectors. And you know, they're not... Maybe people's concerns aren't around those people and they understand that that's a reality of life. It's how much control we have about the flow of people coming in here for to seek protection. Maybe they're coming in here because it's financially favourable to do so. I don't know. But the listeners, I think, can distinguish between those two groups and the generally do pad. But again, you know, with all of the problems that both you and Pat have, you and Paddy have outlined, why would we then sign up to a migrant pact that actually could mean even more people coming in to a system that clearly is not built to deal with them, and then it's going to create more public dissatisfaction?
I mean, clearly we need to change the system, but I do want to recognise one point that it hasn't come out and that is implicit in what you're saying, and that is the challenge of different cultural traditions. And I don't think we have really faced that. For example, the whole question of whether it's normal or not normal in some cultures to carry a knife, the attitudes to women, which exist in some cultures, which are not compatible with where we are now in Ireland. There are real issues.
How
there.
Do you overcome that, though? Because that's the fundamental, because apparently the key to all of this is understanding and integration and all of that type of stuff. The differences are so fundamental that we can't find an example, or perhaps you can give me an example, where the integration that we all recognise needs to be there has actually been done successfully, because the attitudes in some cases in both directions are so fundamentally different.
Well, I do think that we need, ironically, we're not clear enough on our own values and attitudes and expectations of, because we are in this transition stage as a society ourselves, and indeed the North also is. For example, that we are not willing also to say there are certain things that are not acceptable in Ireland today. It's coming close to it in terms of thinking about carrying weapons. We have almost come there here in the South. But in a way, I think we need to be a lot more, confident that actually, if people come to our country, there are certain expectations that we have of what it is to be in our country.
See, Pat, sorry to cut across, but you see, what you've been outlining since I come to you the most recent time is literally pretty much everybody's concerns. That's and you throw in what Paddy mentioned about, and you also referenced it, about a high concentration of people coming into this country in certain areas. That's everything. Yes. That's everything that's got us to this point. It is concerns about cultural clashes, and I don't mean cultural clashes on the street, certain attitudes towards women, attitudes maybe to weapon carrying, this is what it's all about.
So I'm not getting your point, Greg.
But my point is you've highlighted all of the problems that probably got us to where we are now. But what are the solutions?
Well, the government has a huge role to play in providing facilities. It has totally ignored the issue of cultural differences. Like, in a way, I mean, I'm putting it straight back on the government, the civil service, the weakness of politicians who are basically like trying to say, well, you know, we respect difference, so we can't actually say X, Y, and Z. I'm sorry. I think we need to. We also, like, in a way, I've begun to wonder we're not facing cultural change. We're not facing climate change. We have a housing problem. Childcare is still totally ridiculous. Mm. I mean, in a way, it's hard to see how or where the government is actually, and we can't deliver on major projects, where the government is delivering at the minute. So, but I suppose I do feel that this does not, every society at every moment has had challenges of people moving. It's a global world. Yeah. We can't put up a wall and say nobody can come in here. Or if we do, you know, that was tried way back, burn everything British except their coal. That didn't work way back after the war.
I would disagree. I think there's tens of thousands of Irish British people in the UAE, for an example, who have gone there and know that they, firstly, if they steal something, they could face a very serious sanction. But go there knowing that you have to dress a certain way, you have to present yes. yourself in a way, you have to abstain from alcohol for the most part. You're not going to walk through Dubai in a pair of short shorts, for an example. Right, so there are examples, and those countries have proved really quite successful.
Well, I mean, I have a little problem with the UAE in that nobody except Emirati gets citizenship, you know. And if you are retired or don't have a job or don't have money or get sick, you really are in trouble.
Okay.
There is a very narrow concept of what it is to be a citizen. So I wouldn't be very keen on choosing them as an example.
But I'm just saying they are an example, whether you agree with that example or not. And they are incredibly popular. Almost every family listening to this is a direct relation over there. Paddy, do you want to come in there just before the break?
Well, one of the things that we as a country and we as a government can't do is to do nothing here. We're going to have to plan for this. And if I don't know what government department is responsible for overall economic or social planning in the government for the country, but you know, the government needs to set up a department for this. They need to plan all this, because we're going to sleepwalk into a revolution here if we don't plan this. There is plenty of room for people, and people that are coming here, particularly the people that come legally and particularly people that are granted asylum here, through the fullness of time have a great contribution to make. I mean, a child coming into this country, either legally or illegally today, may end up being the Taoiseach in about 40 years' time. And we need to plan for this. I mean, Holland is half the size of Ireland, but it's got three times the population. And what we do a lot of things well in this country, but the things that we don't do well, as Pat said, is about planning. And then when we decide to agree on what to deliver, then we have a problem with okay. delivering it. Every time we build a hospital, it's too small. Every time we build a school, it's too small. Every time we build a bypass to a town, it's out of date. And that may have been okay for us before, but it's not going to be okay for us going into the future with the very new demands that's going to be taking place, because people coming into the country, and once they get established here, they're not going to accept second-class citizenship. And what we've seen in North Belfast and East Belfast, we're going to see that in 40 years' time in places like Galway and Limerick and Cork. All you have to do is remember back a few years ago to Toxteth. Do you remember Bristol in South London, where you had, I'm going to call them migrants, but there were people from overseas. They were coming from the different colonies or whatever. And they seriously objected to the fact that they were being colonized in different areas and more or less left behind. Okay. And we're going to face that if we don't plan for it.
Yes. Right, we'll be back. Pat, I'm going to take a break because Kieran Brogan's joined us as well. We're going to stay on this topic because there's another couple of questions I want to ask, and we've other things to discuss as well. And as you can imagine, there's an awful lot coming in from listeners as well. And I will say it's all reasonable stuff. It's not going to be painted in any way, shape or form. But we'll be back with that in a moment. Councillor Kieran Brogan has joined us. Councillor, I know you were in a meeting with Jack Chambers. I might ask you a question about that at the end. But good morning to you and thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Greg. Apologies for the
Oh, no, unless that was a private meeting. But anyway, I hope it wasn't.
No.
I mean, we've been talking about, and you're late to the conversation, we've been talking about what we've been seeing in Belfast, and previously we've seen the same type of reaction in Dublin. And I really don't think we could rule out ever seeing something like that too in Sligo or Letterkenny, for an example. Just to put a quick question to you, what do we need to be doing to, A, I suppose, defuse the situation, de-escalate, but also to recognise that whilst we all don't agree with burning out communities and that type of activity, that there are genuine concerns that these people are tapping into?
Yeah, well, I think it's very unfortunate that we see what we're seeing happen in Belfast in a year when Belfast actually is taking the first ever FLA. Is going to Belfast this year and next year. There's an awful lot of good work that is happening there with the Cultus and making that happen. And we've seen it before in Letterkenny in 2005 and 2006, and there's a lot of good things happening. And I think, I suppose, I've said it before, Greg, I think how we manage the message is very important. Misinformation is a huge problem. Legitimate media and legitimate messages now are very, very important. I think misinformation is very challenging. But look, all we have to do to look at all the good things that's happened, if I look here locally in Letterkenny and I see in Donegal, and we are a town that has probably well over 50 different nationalities here, there's an awful lot of great work happening in our schools, and a lot of good work happening. And I think some of the behaviour and some of the conduct, and I think some of the politics we have now has become very, very divisive. And I think maybe some of the social media platforms has led to that. But I suppose if we look back at the journey that we've all come through in Northern Ireland politics, I'm somewhat concerned over the last number of years that I think maybe we don't have the same energy and going into the whole journey of the peace process that has been there for some time. And I think we need to take a fresh look at that, because I think we need to try and work harder at mutual respect.
Yeah.
And
do you know you talked about the diversity in Letterkenny, which is there, and it's fantastic. And the majority of that is legal migration, where people have come in and they've worked here and they've had children here and all that kind of stuff. But you also know, Kieran, if you spoke to five guys in a pub and you says, "What's your view on migration?" I would say all of them would say, "You know, there's too much. It's uncontrolled," and they'd be referencing sort of the large groups of, it seems to be often, young men that maybe are coming here for asylum or coming here for a better life, or maybe coming here because of the terms and conditions. And that's where the public anger seems to be, not broadly on migration. Would you accept that that might be what these guys or girls might say to you? And if they do have concerns, do you believe they're genuine?
But if they do say that, are they fully informed? I mean, do they realise that we have... I mean, Letterkenny is probably a very good example, because as long as I've been living here, which is almost 54 years, we've had so many different colours and different people who've made a vast contribution, working on our health service, working on different companies here in Letterkenny. The schools is a prime example of that. And I think what's the some of the messages, the misinformation that's gone out on social media, you know, over the course of the last number of years, I think is not helpful. And I think there's a duty for people to be responsible. And look, I think we can't ignore it as well. And there's an awful lot of good work that's happened by different agencies, but I think we need to try and to get to the root of the problem. And if there has to be more work done in building up that, I suppose, managing the message that's there, because the reality of the situation at the minute, we would not survive now without the influx of so many people that we've had over the last number.
But I want to separate, if that's okay, because I've had people in here, professional people who aren't originally from Ireland, expressing concerns about our migration policy. You know, there are differences here, nuances. Pat, to come back to you. Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
Just one point on that. I mean, if you look at the situation that we've had with our troubles in Northern Ireland over a long number of years, we didn't have social media platforms. We didn't have social media. We didn't have the cameras and stuff that maybe highlighted the incident in Belfast.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's unfortunate that it took us so long to get to a peace process with the troubles that we had, to try and get sensible people to sit down around. It took years to get people to sit down around the table to realise that people can be from different traditions. We need to respect their traditions, allow them to be in that tradition and work harder at it. But over the last number of years, we seem to have maybe take some of that for granted.
But you'd be familiar that in the migration policy we have, there is no education about Irish traditions for people that are coming here seeking asylum.
I think that's wrong to say that there's no education.
Well, I spoke 2 days ago to a consultant in this area, and she said there was none. This is from someone who is an advocate for people coming into this country and also works with them.
Well, I see firsthand, and I mean, I've been around the schools over the course of the last year as mayor, and I mean, the schools is the best example, and I would ask anyone to go into any of the schools that we have, the primary schools and the secondary schools, and the teachers are doing some great, great work. Sporting organisations, for example, are doing some brilliant work. And that's not getting the headline. That's not getting the front page. When we look at our tidy towns, for example, when we look at our community employment schemes throughout the county, it'd be fair to say that by and large, our community employment schemes have really taken the lead and embracing so many different cultures. These people are making a vast contribution. And if you think back to the stories that we would have all heard in the past, Irish people is one people that should understand it, because our own people had to go to so many different parts of the world. And now the Irish are doing so well in different parts of the world. Mm-hmm. So I think we need to try and people need to be more responsible about the misinformation. And
just in relation to, I'm not being defensive, but all of the organisations that you talk of that work on integration, be it through sport, cultural integration, all that type of stuff, they're on this programme incredibly regularly. So they do, it is heavily spotlighted. Pat?
I'd like to come in.
Please do. Yes, so the point just to invite you.
The point I was going to make was that the state is obsessed with economic impact rather than with looking at social change. And this is exemplified by, for example, here in Ireland, Research Ireland, which has basically a budget of 4.5 billion to spend on research, is only focusing on research which has economic impact. So that, and in a way, like you're saying, where's evidence, where's research, what can we do? The state is not really facing issues related to social issues, right? It is the mindset of the state is that it devalues, for example, it devalues social science, which is the science which is concerned with whether it's integration or cultural change or whatever. So there's a fundamental mindset problem. So, and then people are surprised why we can't solve problems. If you don't even recognise that there's a need for research on these issues, and if the state focuses on economic, and if it really excludes from its purview even any kind of concern with bigger issues, whether it is, cultural integration, it's going to, there isn't going to be a solution, because the schools and the cultural associations and sport, these are voluntary groups. Yes, they can make a difference at a local level, but really you need state driving.
Yeah, sometimes I think like I'm losing the plot, because like, that when we talk about people working in the health service or in the community or in hospitality or in schools, for an example, often they might have just arrived here, or there could be second or third generation people with a different heritage or background. Again, the public, from what I can gain, the public are not, that's not their concern. They're their neighbours and friends. Their concern is often large groups of people coming into an area, and they are predominantly often men, not exclusively, and they are young men. They're not going into the school. And that is where the majority of the concern seems to be. If you look at all of the concern that's been expressed, Pat, it is not. And as I said before, some of the people that have come here and work here and live here share the concerns. You know what I mean?
Difficulty is once, and this point has been made by Patrick, once a match is set, then people, and once you have people running around basically with racist attitudes, hating on the basis of colour, then they won't and don't differentiate between who they are actually targeting.
I don't think it's
and
about
how
colour.
Do you know, okay. How can you build those and sustain anyway, like in a way you want to change the attitude to otherness, because people are going to be here before they.
Okay, but listen, I'm going to say this. I'm not putting this out misinformation, but I don't see any issue with Polish people coming here, Ukrainians people coming here, and I'm going to say the part out loud. Right. Even people, people from Africa with a Christian background. You know, you don't see the same types of conversations or concerns.
I know, but Greg, can I just make a point here? I mean, you're talking about gangs of men with dark skin or whatever. I mean, all you have to do is watch Primetime or the RT News or listen to business people and people living in Dublin. There's a concern as well about gangs of young white men
Of
going
course there
around
is. Yeah, for
in groups
sure.
as well, and they're a proxy for organized crime, and they're involved. All you had to do is look at the riots that took place in O'Connell Street and Henry Street. That's exactly what converged in the place of the gangs. This was as a result of the attack by a guy on the creche or whatever. But there was gangs of, nobody wants to see gangs of white young men in a group going around either, by the way. It's just that there might be a little bit more tension and stress. And can I just, what Pat's last contribution there about, the difference between economic planning and social planning, it's just a different way of the point I made about 10 minutes ago about the need for some form of serious planning in this country, because we have a lot of other things that's going to blow up in our face here about our aging population, about the level of pensions that have to be paid, and the fact we have a decreasing level of a productive workforce to pay for all of this. That air is going into the balloon all the time, but suddenly, unless somebody does something about it, it's going to blow in our face. So there's about four or five sort of key issues here, and they appear to be disconnected, but they're actually all connected here. And the sooner we get ahead of them, the better. And can I just make one point? I know, Kieran, that you were coming late to the party, and he made reference to the Flagg Ceoil going to Belfast. And I listed out about seven or eight reasons there why loyalists feels disaffected. Actually, the coming of the Flagg Ceoil is just another thing that's going to upset them, because they're going to see Irish dancing, Irish culture, Irish music coming to the fore, vibrant, thousands of people coming into the Belfast. And they're going to be looking at that over there and say, well, there they go again. They're getting ahead again. And what about poor us?
If I could just come in on that one, Greg.
No, of course, yes. Carry on, Kieran. It's an
Yeah,
open convo,
just
open
on
platform.
Paddy's comments around the Flan. I'm glad Paddy made the comments. But I remember when the Flan Ceoil na hÉireann and Laura Samora, who has been head of that organisation, and we've had a lot of dealings with them in Letterkenny. And I remember when they went into Derry as well, we went into it and enjoyed it. And to be honest, it's the culture. And the Flan is actually a great opportunity for unionism and nationalists to come together to share the culture. And I think there was a great example when the Flan was in Derry when that happened. When I went over to Eppington Square, and we seen the orange bands playing on the stage, and believe it or not, it was a great example of both communities coming together. And I would have to commend the unionist community in Derry at the time. They embraced the Flan in so many ways, and it's an example of people actually sharing their culture, sharing what they have, and I think we need to do more of this. And I believe, I have every confidence, because I know the people involved in the Flan, that the same will be happening in Belfast. It'll actually be an opportunity for people to come together to share their culture, and people are entitled to have their culture. And irrespective of what music or what band you have, everyone have different cultures, and they'll be entitled to do it. So the Flan will actually embrace it. And as I say, when it happened in Derry, it was a great opportunity, because it couldn't have happened in Derry at the time,
Okay.
only for the support that came from the unionism community as well. And that they have to be commended for that. And while we speak, there'll be an awful lot of planning over the last while going in to make it happen in Belfast. And I've every confidence that'll be a really, really good, successful, because you know why? The secret of the Flan, and maybe some government agencies could learn from this. It won't be about stat graphics and numbers. It'll be community from the bottom up. It'll be community. It'll be owned by the community. It'll be policed by the community. And the atmosphere around that will be very, very good. So I've every confidence that the Flan in Belfast will be an opportunity. And I think we do need in Northern Ireland at the moment, and maybe some parts of our own community, we need to work harder and do whatever we can do at building mutual respect among all traditions and all communities. And I think we continue to do that. And that is happening in schools. I see it firsthand. But I think the element outside of that, and people who's disconnected from that, don't really see the good things that's happening in tidy towns, in community employment schemes, in sporting organisations, because I see firsthand an awful lot of
Yeah,
really
and
good
in the
work.
arts as well, of course. Yeah, okay, back with more from our guests after these. As you can imagine, there's been a huge reaction to our conversation so far, because it is making all the headlines, it has to be said. But of course, this has kind of opened up a conversation about the potential for a conversation about cross-border movement policies. You know, they do say never waste a crisis, and those that perhaps would love to see a harder border between the Republic and the North are using this as an opportunity, because the alleged assailant came into Dublin, moved to Belfast, and was granted leave to stay there. Do you think that, Paddy, I'll start with you if that's okay. Do you think that these calls for tighter border controls will gather legs, or will this just blow over and the status quo will remain?
Well, the momentum, of course, for all this about the border is coming predominantly from two areas, and that's the DUP and the TUV in Northern Ireland, and it's not coming from the British government and certainly not coming from the Irish government. You must remember, the TUV weren't around when a Good Friday Agreement was agreed in 1994. The DUP did not partake in that, remember, in any of the talks, and never signed up to it. So they don't want it. And this is just an opportunity now for them two political parties to weaponize an open border. I mean, we have a lot of honest traffic from north to south and south to north by people either working in the opposite directions or doing business in the opposite directions or tourism or whatever it is, and it seems to be working very well. But it's sticking in the craw of the DUP and particularly the TUV about the fact we have an open border
but
now.
You will see Gardaí Customs or whatever the personnel is. I'm not going to pretend I know for sure, but you do see reports of them on trains and buses ensuring that there's no illegal traffic north to south. And I think the TUV particularly took issue that, you know, that there's no checks in the other direction.
Well, Mary Regan of The Independent was on The Tonight Show there on Virgin Media a few nights ago, and she was saying that even though the information is very, very scant, that there are more people coming from north to south in relation to getting access to this country as there are people going from south to north.
Okay.
I mean, if people are serious about this, Greg, and stop weaponizing the border, is that the place to scrutinize movement is at the sea borders. Mm-hmm. It's at Rosslare, it's at Dunleary, it's at Larne and places like that. But of course, it doesn't suit the narrative for those two political parties to be talking about that, because they're not overly, they're not concerned, or if they are concerned about illegal migration coming into Northern Ireland, they're focusing on the border between Donegal and County Louth. That's the natural place for it to take place, at the sea border. But of course, it doesn't suit their narrative to say that.
Kieran, I mean, we know more than any on this island how important that open border is, because we don't see it. It's not there. Is migration such a motivating issue that, you know, the likes of the TUV and others, their campaign for tighter controls may grow legs, or do you think this will just be fleeting and pass?
Yeah, well, I suppose I'd agree with Paddy. A lot of the steps that have been taken over the last number of years, particularly since Brexit, and look, we know what Brexit has done for Britain. It was the destructive button. It was hard to believe that somebody could do what they did do. Nevertheless, I think our economy has really, really thrived and doing really well. And what Paddy's saying is correct. I mean, if you go to Belfast, you go to Derry, I mean, there's so much happening between employment and between so many good things, between Belfast and Dublin, between this region here. I mean, the amount of people from our northern six counties who'd be employed in Donegal, and the amount of people from Donegal who's employed in our health service and right across all the services is huge. And we've always had the challenge about the development of the region, and we need to have the open borders. I mean, partition has failed us in the past, but I do really believe that there's a job to do from a nationalist perspective to work harder to try and instill some confidence into unionism, that they have nothing to fear from a nationalist or indeed a United Ireland either, but because we need to try and do it in a way that they're a part of that journey, that they feel a partner, because if this is to work and we're to see Irish unity, they will be a big partner in that journey, and they need to know that there's nothing to fear from that. And I think back to the early days of the peace process, when people did sit down around the table, people who we never envisaged or never thought would be sitting around the table, that they did sit around the table because they believed the time was right to try and give that renewed confidence. Right. I think we need to get back to that again,
yeah,
because We need to, if there is a fear, and some people like Jim Allister and his kind will be trying to create as much fear as possible. And I think if you get back to what I said earlier about legitimate media, I think some of the programmes that I watch now, the politicians are not being held to account in the way they would have been years ago in studios and stuff. And I think they're getting away with the social media platforms. And I think if you go back to the days when people was in a studio and somebody could be held to account or asked or challenged on their policy, I think that has not been done as much as maybe it used to be in the past. We need to get back to that. Mm. But there needs to be a clear message that, look, this island is big enough for us all to live and work together in harmony with mutual respect.
I understand. Thank you very much for that. Yeah, and I would agree with that last point that you made as well, particularly. Last word to you, if that's okay, Professor O'Connor, in a minute, just in terms of whatever you want to wrap on, if you want to address the board.
Okay. Well, I think Paddy is spot on, but it obviously all depends what happens in the UK. If Nigel Farage, for example, his party does well and he's prime minister, obviously it's a game changer. So that's really all I have to say.
Professor Pat O'Connor, thank you so very much. Always love you on the show. Councillor Kieran Brogan, thank you for joining us. And Paddy Rooney, of course, a great friend of the show as well. All three of you, thank you very much indeed. Now, thank you so much to all of you who've been texting in. And when I say hundreds of comments, by the way, we don't exaggerate on the programme. We just tell you as it is. We're very honest with you. And the amount of people texting in on what has been happening in Northern Ireland, and I suppose the wider issue that's got us there, is literally in the hundreds. Multiple messages per page here, and I've got tons of them. If I was stopped at a Garda checkpoint and had a knife in my car, I'm wondering what would happen to me. Our government has lost the running of this country. It's shocking. Young people had to leave in their droves to get employment in other countries. Now they're bringing in people that are here for the terms and conditions. Greg is brilliant. The panel are consciously unable to take his direction and the perspective he presents, despite his efforts a few times to draw their attention to the real issues regarding immigration. He's properly shown the bigger picture with his questions, and they only want to see and speak about the corner they're comfortable in. Nothing they say resonates with the average Irish person who's deeply concerned about immigration. It's a whitewash the panel is giving, and that's not helping the tension that is building. In all matters, including immigration, the truth sets us free. That's everyone, despite our DNA, our colours, our origin, our faith. We are all human, but we cannot be a society unless we share values and demand that everyone fulfil their part. I appreciate that, and I read that because I thought, and this is no disrespect to the panel, I know my interaction with people, and people come up to me and we chat, and I know what people feel, and I know the type of people, and I understand what the concerns are, and they're not racist, and they're not pull up the drawbridge, blah, 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 blah. A lot of them just have genuine concerns that struggle to be able to articulate them without being painted as one thing or another. I appreciate the feedback there. Let me see. When you see that what was a divide in the north for years come together, then you know the government messed up big time. This won't go away and will get worse unless government address the lazy immigrant, the non-worker that won't get on a CE scheme, that wants the social welfare and all the trimmings it brings. This cannot happen and will only strengthen the citizens of Ireland. I am actually going to... I think what you're talking about there can be across... whether people live here or immigrants. I think that's across the board, really, because there is a stubborn amount of people in this country with all different backgrounds that never work. Greg, our own people, women and girls, and also men, have to be protected from some immigrants that come here only to target people and follow women with children. And these men don't work, or they don't want to work, only prowl. Well, they can't work, right? But listen, I've tried to raise that issue. I know that's one of the concerns people have. I talked about, maybe is it a cultural difference? It's not across the board, by the way, but it does happen. And I've tried to inquire if there is some sort of cultural education that, you know, obviously people living here all the time, they obviously have to, you know, meet people, but the people coming here have to meet them in the middle as well and understand that, you know, things are different, that you will see women in strappy tops and fellas, in if that's your thing, invests, and that's the way life is here, and it's fine. Some people see that in a different way, dependent on where you may be from. I don't know. Kieran Brogan is very right. Dialogue and community events are so important to allay fears. There's huge work being done in our schools to foster diversity and care for all children. Don't think these other countries would be so accommodating as far as our religion is concerned. Big difference trying to pass a group of those men who have no women with them and nothing to keep them occupied. Another asked the Chamber of Commerce how much money is being spent annually by iPass Centre providers on ShopLK vouchers. It's millions, they say. Greg, you only have to look at the numbers of unemployed migrants on welfare in Lower Main Street, Letterkenny, and in isolated villages, which is a bad recipe for the future. That comes in from Daniel. That's bad management. Another, if it weren't for social media, we would never have heard of these atrocities. Social media has given us a platform to air our freedom of speech where TD's government are not listened to. I get where you're coming from, but for some people, being on social media is a job. It's a job in terms of interaction. It's a job in terms of, support the work that we're doing. And there's different things happening on social media. There are some people that it is. Tommy Robinson, for an example, he is a professional agitator. Now, you might agree with some of what he says, or you might disagree completely with what he says, but he is a professional agitator. And he makes an awful lot of money. He's incredibly wealthy. His family fly around the world on private jets at times. He is out of the country living it up an awful lot of the time. So, some people like that are not the other people that you're talking of. They get their money from views and clicks, and he's getting tens of thousands of euro from X every single month. You know, turn off monetization if it's really about just how people, the lives of people. Another, I think that unionists should be invited into Letterkenny on the 12th of July to march as a gesture of goodwill. We need to meet them halfway if they can give their flyer to Belfast. I'm also, I don't think a lot of what we're seeing either in Northern Ireland is religious base per se. A lot of it, I think, it is geography and where there have been big changes in community. It's not in the affluent areas. It's in working class areas that already had perhaps a high level of property vacancy. Those properties have been taken over or repurchased. And I think some of them happen to be in those areas. Maybe I'm wrong. And if I'm not in Northern Ireland, maybe I shouldn't be sticking my nose into their matters. But I don't necessarily think it's loyalist versus Republican. I think a lot of it can just be literally where the concentration of people are. Let me know if I'm wrong there, please. The government policy is what is causing the problem, believes the listener. People are not upset about a genuine person coming to work and to integrate into our country, which is the point I was trying to make. That is it. The worst I've ever heard from regular people is that sometimes when someone's come here recently and they're working in the healthcare or what have you, is that they might struggle to understand their accent. It's never about where they come from or their colour or their race. It's not about that. I don't see a problem in this country with legal migration per se. I mean, obviously you'll get some really hardliners that will. But that often then gets thrown in with what really I think is a concern to people. But anyway, I'll read on because this listener's opinion is far more important than me adding to it. I'll pick it up here. Genuine person coming to work and integrate into our country. The Irish were never racist, and it's still not. No matter what the research or government media say, it's just people finally speaking up about the threat to culture and identity. They know this was coming, hence the training up of the Gardaí during lockdown. I'm not sure anyone was able to plan or has the ability to plan to that level, but I take your point. This caller believes diversity doesn't work. They tried to do it in France and Germany and London. England is not working. People keep coming up with misinformation and disinformation, and people are using this. Are the biggest bluffers, and I'd be speaking to a lot of teachers and they're not happy by what they're being made do. How do you know, Greg, that most of the migrants in Letterkenny is legal? I don't know. I never said that. Tell Kieran that the government... I did say that. I never said Letterkenny into the country. The overwhelming majority are legal. They're coming here either via free movement from Europe or on work visas. I know that. The statistics are there. The amount coming in here for protection or for whatever reason they've come in here and end up in IPAS centres, what have you, is actually really quite small in the wider context of the movement of people. But I didn't say Letterkenny, I said across the country. But this caller says, we're filling our health service with immigrants and our very best at emigrating due to government treatment over the years. Some of that, some of it is just like, I know some people in my family, they just want that experience of travel as well. Another, did they really suggest to look at the schools to see how well new arrivals are doing in Ireland? Seriously, maybe they should be in the streets after dark or the parks, etc. Even the Garda station, who know but didn't add nationality to report sheets. Well, I think anything, and I've said this before, anything that helps identify a perp should be included if you want to police properly. Is this a joke? It's not about legal immigration and the good they do. It's about unvetted potential criminals, they say, doing what they think is normal from their country and our country. Beheadings and the amount of people they are letting in. Again, you know, like the alleged perpetrator, I have to be careful. I don't want to be framed as if I'm coming from a particular angle, but I want everyone, I want, the reality is the UN, the reality is the UN has cited Sudan on a number of occasions, quite specifically for beheading, particularly in the war that's going on there. Not all of the Sudanese people, because like any other country, there's different people with different... But it has actually been mentioned specifically, and of course the alleged perpetrator happened to be from that country. So, you know, when someone says about importing stuff, it's crude language, but, you know, what kind of an education is there to say that, you know, that this is completely unacceptable in this country? Carrying a weapon is completely unacceptable. Is that happening? And although the Irish people are worried about their families, and Greg, you're right, it's not about colour. I really genuinely don't believe it is. Another, Letterkenny and migration. If you go south, County Dublin, Dalkey, etc., there's no immigration down there. Why do they only place immigrants to some places like Sligo, Letterkenny, and there are many, many others as well. Right, OK, there's still so many comments there that I didn't quite get through, but we will catch up as the morning wears on. Now, the Greg Hughes podcast released every Friday morning at 11 o'clock, and I have to say I'm really pleased to see it starting to get some great traction. Podcasts aren't necessarily judged by, you know, you release a podcast today and a million people view it. It's not really like that. It's about, it builds a community and people listen over time at the leisure, and it's great to see the Greg Hughes podcast sort of getting there, you know, across the various platforms. You can listen to the podcast every morning or download it every Friday morning at 11 o'clock, and we've got, you know, dozens of episodes up there now with people with all different backgrounds, but all of them are very interesting people with great stories. And you can also get it wherever you get your podcasts. Just search The Greg Hughes Show wherever you get podcasts and you will find it. But our guest this week is someone I thought I knew, Carolyn Murray. She's a familiar name to many out there because she's has a leadership role, a directorship of the Shandon Hotel. She's a very strong advocate for industry, the tourism industry, particularly across Donegal. I know all that, and I know she's a very impressive professional woman. But what I didn't understand is how she got there, and also what she's had to deal with in her life, because behind the professional success lies a story of profound resilience. And in this preview of our full interview, Carolyn shares a very poignant memory from when she was just 18 years old.
Everything was going well, and then when I was 18 then, my sister tragically died in my arms from an asthma attack. We had a holiday home in the Downings. It was my partner Chris's caravan. And the next morning, now she always had brittle asthma, so she always did suffer, but it would flare up, you know, and there'd be times she would have no issues. But this particular time in the Downings that morning, she took a severe asthma attack and she died in my arms on the way when we were trying to meet the ambulance. So in the back of the car, she tragically, like, I knew that she had died because I couldn't feel her pulse and I couldn't feel any breath because she was lying on me. They got her on life support then, and obviously the hope that everybody had, her husband, she had two young kids, and my parents and my brothers and sisters, everybody thought that she was going to be okay, but I knew she was gone for too long. Wow. You know, so after 2 days of everyone being so hopeful and praying and the Padre Pio glove and everything, in my heart I knew but I couldn't share it with anyone because I didn't want to break their hope.
No.
But obviously, there was no brain activity, so they had to turn the machines off after 2 days.
How did you cope with that?
People always say, oh, you're so strong and everything else, but you're not at the time. You just, I think it's just shock and survival and just being able to get up in the morning and put one foot in front of the other at times like that. And I don't know if I coped with it very well. I think then, you know, I'm such an empath that I was worried about my mum.
Yeah.
I was worried about my sister's kids, like me and my sister. There's only 5 years between us. I was only 18. She was only 5 years older. So we were best friends as well. And then her husband, who was left with 2 kids. And obviously me and Chris, my partner at the time, we were there for Kevin, her husband, her late husband. He's now dead too. And the 2 kids. But it was just, I think I just went into a mode of just trying to help everybody else.
Mm-hmm. And did that help you, or did it defer perhaps?
I think it deferred it for a while, and then just throwing yourself into work. Like, I just completely, and God forgive me, but it kind of catapulted my career, and then I became the advertising sales manager because being at home and being alone was too much to deal with.
Yeah.
So I literally just worked around the clock.
People listening, you know, will understand that this is the most horrendous thing anyone could ever go through, you know, their best friend, close sister. But the fact that you were there with her when she passed, is that a blessing or a curse? Is it a blessing that you were there with her in those final moments, or is it something that you've had to carry with you the whole time, Karen?
Sorry.
It's okay. Do you want to move on to...
It's okay. No one's ever asked me that question.
I'm sorry.
It's just difficult because... I'll catch my breath. Nowadays, you have so much training in the hotel business and, you know, first responder, and, like, I'm a first responder and there's 20 of my team trained. If we had had that training back then, she'd probably still be alive. You know, but back 20-odd years ago, nobody knew what to do. Even with her asthma, you think that we would have knew to, like, try and learn compressions or something. Mm. You know, so that's difficult. But at the same time, I was there with her when she passed, so that is nice. But at the same time, you still feel guilty that now, that with my knowledge now, obviously I didn't have it then, maybe we could have done something, you know.
Yeah. And there's an obvious thing I could say, but I don't think this is something that you've thought about and you've already worked out yourself. Nothing I'm going to say is going to... But there is nothing else you could have done because you had that knowledge at that time.
That's it. We didn't
and
know that.
And we can't change history, that we've got much more awareness of CPR. And it's just all we can do, is, I suppose, is focus on that she wasn't alone, that she had her best, her favourite person with her.
True.
Outside of the children.
Yeah.
Did you? It's interesting that you say that this sort of spurred you on, and I can actually see the logic to that. But before I get back to that point and pick up on that point, what you did do subsequently, though, is trying to, you know, make some changes and promote EpiPens, etc., something that might prevent a person going through what your sister went through.
Yeah, me and my family then, we did a bit of campaigning after she died, because asthma is an allergy reaction as well at times. And I think, like, I'm not a doctor, I don't understand all the medical stuff, but I do know that any time she did go into hospital, adrenaline was the first thing that they would give her, and that would really settle her down. So we were campaigning at the time to have EpiPens given to asthma patients, but we weren't successful at the time. I'm not sure now if that's the case, but it is something that, you know, we felt so strongly at the time. We were just too far away from the Downings to the Letterkenny Hospital. And if she had got there quicker, if we had had, like, she always had nebulizers, you know.
But there's lots of maybes in there, isn't there? Because even her transportation to the hospital, and this is stuff that was actionable at the time, you know, you can beat yourself up about if we had time machines, right? But that's out of your control. Yeah. What was in your control was her, how she was transported to the hospital, potential delays there, perhaps some of the most difficult things to deal with.
Yeah, it was a difficult, I mean,
could have been partially our fault, but when we put in the emergency call, I don't think they realised how much of an emergency it was. So when we met them at the Hull in Remelton, her husband was driving, I was in the back. The ambulance man came very slowly and was trying to talk to Sarah, and I was like panicking, saying, you know, she's unconscious, you know, she hasn't been breathing. She's like, I didn't want to say that while her husband was driving, because he was obviously very worried as well. So when they arrived, they soon realised how much of an emergency it was, and they just probably weren't equipped, you know, and it could have been our fault because we didn't explain it to them. But even the blue lights and everything else, and they turned a corner, but she wasn't even strapped in, you know, and she came on top of me. And then just arriving at the hospital, they just weren't prepared, and I can't blame them for it, because after that they were great. When we arrived into the hospital, I just followed in, and obviously it was a severe emergency. She was in resus and they had to cut her clothes off and they had to get at her heart straight away. So then they noticed that I was in the room and they were screaming at me to get out, and it was just traumatic. And when I went to reception, they were asking me, what's her name? And I couldn't even remember. And then they were like, is this your sister? And I was like, I couldn't even think.
We really appreciate Carolyn sharing that story. And you know, just literally 2 years later, you heard her reference her partner at the time, Chris, and they were starting to build a life together, and were well on the way to that. And in a remarkable twist of fate, the next time she was in Downing's was with her partner, Chris, as I mentioned a couple of weeks ago, and he tragically died as well, which, as I say, I was completely unaware of. And Caroline, or Carolyn, I should say, talks to us about that. And also from that, her family, separation from her husband, and building up to the person that she is now, and life in business, life as head and director of the Shandon Hotel, and her plans for the future, etc. So it's a wide-ranging conversation, and we really appreciate Carolyn's honesty and frankness, and her willingness to share. And we only put a clip of that ad on the show yesterday, and I've already received direct messaging on socials saying that the clip, the short clip that I put up as a preview, was already helping people, which is really quite remarkable, the power of conversation. That full conversation with Carolyn Murray is available on Highland Radio's website from 11 o'clock or wherever you get your podcasts. Now, Mr. Artur Michalski is the Chargé d'Affaires ad interim of the Republic of Poland in Ireland, and he is in Donegal, and he joins me now. Great to have you on the programme. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Is this your first time in the county? I don't believe it is it? Or was it your predecessor that I may have spoken to?
You know, not really. I'm here in Ireland just 1 year and a half, but this is my the third visit of Donegal County.
Definitely, first one I have spoken to you.
The last year on vacation, you know, it's lovely vacation in Donegal County.
What about this invite to officially launch the 39th Annual Errigal Arts Festival programme and brochure? I mean, this is a very important and big event for us here in the Northwest. And I think it's great that, and quite actually, I think it was a great idea for you to be invited to do this, Artur, if I can say.
Yes, I heard about this festival, a famous festival, and probably you know that during this Irish presidency in the EU, Poland was linked with Donegal County. Each county in Ireland is linked to the particular member states of the EU, and we have this honor, privilege, and pleasure to be linked to Donegal County. So I think there's a reason for me to come and to be present at this launch of this famous festival. And we'll have also some Polish, say, a flavor we will add to this festival. We invited some dancer, as I understand. So yes, there will be also Polish traces in this festival.
Yes, indeed. And Polish people have a long reputation, a long history of course, living in Donegal and the rest of Ireland, but also, you know, opportunities to celebrate Polishness, Polish culture, dance, food. And, you know, I've been at a number of them. So there's always been a strong tradition, I think, and good camaraderie, particularly in the Northwest here.
I think, you know, this I would say, common adventure of being linked during the Irish presidency will strengthen links between our nations. I think Poles and Irish people have lots in common, and I see here, I mean, as you know, we have quite numerous Polish diaspora. It's almost 100,000 people here, some of them already coming back because of the level of Poland being significantly improved. But still, I would say that Polish diaspora here is, harmoniously integrated into Irish society, and I would even say that in a way it's already an indispensable part of Irish society. So Poles feel here very well because this is a very hospitable country and great people.
Yes, for sure. And many Polish people came here in the 90s and settled and have families and what have you. They've been here for generations, and some returned and some come back. And there's just that sort of fluency between the two countries, it seems. Fluidity.
Yes, right now, you know, Paul, Europe becomes, in a way, smaller and smaller. We have wonderful connections. So sometimes people live here and at the same time are quite frequent visitors to Poland, visiting families, native homes. So, you know, I think this is extremely important right now, especially right now when we have probably not so easy times. We live right now to strengthen this understanding between peoples and also to contribute in the sense to make Europe more united, more strong. Yeah.
Just one question on your home nation, Arthur, if that's okay. I mean, obviously, you know, Poland very close to what's happening in the eastern part of our continent, bordering Russia and what have you. What's the day-to-day sense of life there? Is it like an impending threat, or, you know, or is it making sure that you prepare for all eventualities? Of course, many Ukrainians move to Poland because of its proximity, but I'm just curious what life is like there, given your proximity to what is actually happening. Because with all the social media and mainstream media, we do still feel very removed from what's happening there, I think, on the most western points of Europe.
You know, of course, geography matters. I mean, here in Ireland, we're, of course, geographically very distant from what's going on in Ukraine, where Russia brutally invaded Ukraine. Of course, in Poland, it's a different story. We are very close. We are bordering Ukraine, and we feel this here quite distantly, I would say. This is why, during our presidency in the EU, which was a year ago, we put lots of emphasis and accent on strengthening security of the whole Europe. And I'm also really happy that one of the priorities of the upcoming Irish presidency in the EU is also security. So we have to think how to make Europe stronger, and of course we have to show a constant solidarity with Ukrainian people who were invaded, and who this is European people who just struggle for the independence. Mm.
One final question in relation to that. Ukraine has very bravely defended itself and is seemingly very much on the offensive at the moment, constructing their own long-range missiles, very effective within Russia, in fact, in terms of their drone deployment. And also, it would seem, starting to tap into the Russian public psyche. Is that just really what I'm being exposed to, or do you get a sense that, you know, that the Ukrainian efforts could be leading us to a resolution that's more on their terms than perhaps might have been previously anticipated?
You know, Ukraine is defending itself, and this is, of course, up to Ukraine to choose what is the proper tactic and strategy to protect Ukraine and to win this war. So right of Ukraine to defend itself in a way Ukraine thinks is more effective.
Yes, and thankfully we have our freedom, and it's been hard fought for, and that allows great events like the one taking place today to take place. And in honour of you kindly accepting the invite to launch the festival and its brochure, there's a fantastic event taking place at the Villa Rose Hotel and Spa in Ballybuffet at 1 p.m. It's a beautiful setting. The Finn Valley Men's Choir are going to be there. And as you say, a custom menu prepared by their executive head chef, Richard McKee, and Polish-born chef, Martin Stolar, showcasing traditional Polish sweet treats and culinary influences. So you're in for an absolute treat, and all those who will be lucky enough to be present, because we're launching something, of course, here in Donegal, but also tipping our hat to your heritage as well, Arthur.
Yes, I'm really happy that in 2.5 hours I should be there, and yes, also taste this a little bit of Polish food you mentioned. So yes, I'm really happy to be part of this launch. Yep.
Lovely, thank you so much for speaking to us, Mr. Arthur Miholski. Enjoy your visit here. I'm sure it won't be the last. And again, as I say, it brings a nice touch to the launch of this very important festival. Thank you so much indeed. And Mr. Artur is the charged affairs and ad interim of the Republic of Poland to Ireland. The Errigal Arts Festival, which the launch of the brochure takes place today, runs from the 10th to the 25th of July in 2026. And as always, it's a celebration of Irish arts, Irish culture, but also has a wonderful sort of mix in there. And there's some fantastic stuff going on. I'm sure we're going to end up talking about that either on this show or John Breslin's show before the event itself. But we just wanted to recognise Mr. Miholski's visit to the county and the launch of that brochure. Donegal are ready. Cork are ready. McCool Park is ready. Are you ready? Because tomorrow, 3 o'clock, throw in Donegal versus Cork. A huge game in round 2A of the Donegal Football All-Ireland Senior Championship. It is live and free for you to listen to here on Highland Radio. Oisín Kelly, Brendan Kilcoyne, Brendan Devaney will be in McCool Park with the build-up, the match live, and of course post-match analysis. Mary Coughlan is chairperson of Donegal GEA. And Mary, we should never, and we don't do, we take for granted that here we are in summer, deep into the championship, still involved, still in with a shout. It's wonderful to be here, isn't it?
It is. Good morning, Greg. Look, this is going to be a challenge. I know that people were buoyed after our great win in Kerry, but I'm sure Jim has acknowledged the fact that Cork are a big team. They were in the league final. They were narrowly beaten in the Munster final. So they're not coming up for a holiday to McCool Park. They're coming up to win, no more than we're there to win as well. So we respect very much the fact that we're at a stage now in the championship where anything can happen and anyone can win.
Yes, and I saw Sinead Breen had some images out from the pitch. It's looking fantastic, isn't it?
It is. And first of all, I want to thank our friends in St Eunan's for facilitating the first round of the championship. They did a huge amount of work, a lot of volunteers there, and it went very well despite the result. That wasn't St Eunan's fault. But I'm delighted that McCool's is available for this game. and the huge amount of work and praise to all of the members of McCune's Club, and particularly the executive, and the development of the park has been fantastic. It looks like a carpet. And I suppose I want to take the opportunity as well to issue advice to respect the park. It's taken a huge amount of money, and it has it's a prize for the club, and they want to make sure that it stays that way. So I'm asking the people, despite the fact that they might be tempted not to go on the pitch on this occasion, it really would damage the pitch, and it's in its infancy, and it's available for this inter-county game. So we just want to respect the fact that so much work has been done, and we don't want the field destroyed. Mm. But hopefully it's going to be an exciting day, and everything will be up on our social media, where to park, where the entrances are for all of the stand, for the so that will be available now today, so people please use it. It is a shopping day in Ballybuffet, as we know, so please take time to park properly, and the Gardaí will be there as well to facilitate you and help you. And I know that the stand is not numbered, but I don't want a situation where people are going to be standing from 11 o'clock in the day waiting to get in. People, once you have a ticket, you will be facilitated.
Yeah, indeed. It's a sellout, of course, and it's live here on Highland Radio and elsewhere, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. A lot of people, you know, frustrated it's not on the TV in one form or other. To some extent, I suppose it feels a bit traditional the way it's going to be this week. Mm-hmm. What's your perspective on this as chair of the Donegal GEA? Do you have to roll with the punches, Mary, and just say, right, well, this is the way the games have been divvied up? Is there a frustration or disappointment? Yeah. It's not televised. I'm not going to.
Well,
put,
I know.
Yeah, go ahead.
People are disappointed. I suppose we were slightly spoiled in that nearly all of our games have been on television. And I suppose it created an expectation that all the games would be on TV. Ourselves, Kerry and Dublin won't be on television on this occasion. I would say you had plenty of conversation, people giving out about GAA Plus. Now people want GAA Plus, so you know it's very hard to get it right. But it is a national agreement. It was actually discussed at county committee. And unfortunately, as a consequence, we weren't able to stream it ourselves. But maybe something that we could put forward at convention to allow that to happen within the frameworks that are there. There are national frameworks. It's a matter for RTE and for GAA Plus to decide. But on this occasion, we weren't in a position. They're not in a position to facilitate it. But as you said, the radio stations will be there, and we'll also be doing
socials.
The socials as well, ourselves, and I'm sure yourselves as well.
Yeah, so, for sure.
So
I mean, even
sellout, it's going to be a great occasion.
Yeah, of course, and maybe even a closed circuit kind of set up in the past. Maybe in the future, maybe, you know, if it's available specifically in cinemas or something, if you want to control the IP, which I can understand that would be the case. But sure, anyway, that's a conversation for convention. I have some of the parking information here, so I'm going to thank you for joining us. Look forward. We're all looking forward to hopefully a fantastic day tomorrow. And safe trip, by the way, to everyone going to the game, especially those travelling great distance from Cork. They'll get a great reception when they arrive.
The other thing which I was terribly disappointed about in Kerry was the lack of respect for some of our players, and I'm sure that won't be the case for the Cork people. We'll be there to welcome them. They put in the same effort as our boys. They're very welcome. It's great to see a big team come from the south all the way up, and hopefully, as I said, we will continue the ethos that we have in the GAA, which is respect for all.
Yeah, I really appreciate what you're saying there, because there's certain things and how we behave that makes GAA so special. We don't want to be inheriting anything from any other disciplines. I'm not saying that's what you're saying. It's just I don't want to.
No,
see
I'm
it.
Just saying that. Yeah.
Okay.
It's a family occasion, and we'll have people there from all walks of life, and hopefully it'll be an enjoyable day, and people will be safe as well on the road. And as well, we have our minor All-Ireland final at 7:30 in Armagh afterwards. These guys have done really, really well. They're playing loud, and hopefully, I know it's going to be a long day, hopefully we will see as many people going there to support these young people as well.
Fantastic stuff. A caller wants to know, lastly, have the toilets had any work done at McCool Park since, or is that in the offing, or is that a Sean McCool situation?
Well, there's some work done. Not all of the work that has been granted has been completed. The big thing was to get this pitch ready. but there will be adequate facilities provided. As always, we've had our meetings and hopefully things will go well.
Good stuff. Thank you very much indeed. Mary Coughlan, Chair of Donegal GEA. Now, parking, if you're going to the game, and please allow yourself plenty of time, because as Mary quite rightly pointed out, it's a business as usual in the Twin Towns and it can be really busy at the weekend. So Bala Buffet does get extremely busy on Championship match days. Nafany Car Park, that's located just past Aldi as you come into the town, dependent on which side you come into, of course. Super Value Car Park, signed right at the junction into Navity Car Park, the shopping centre car park right beside the McIlhenny stores in the middle of the town. The Gardaí really want to make sure the footpaths are free for people who need them and that emergency services can get around as they would need to, God forbid, in the case of an emergency. So I haven't had a specific warning from Angada Síochána to share with you, but I do know that they do and have begun to quite heavily enforce illegal parking around these big games wherever they might happen to be. So don't leave yourself stuck, especially if you win. You don't want to win and then come out and find you've got a ticket or something along those lines. Yeah, a caller says, hopefully the field holds up good as the past 10 days the weather and rain doesn't cut up new surfaces. I hope so too. I have this vision in my head of slipping and sliding and it cutting up, but not because it hasn't been done correctly. I'm sure it's been done fantastically. It's just that you just see that sometimes with new pitches, and I hope it's not the case. We want it to be all about the football. And interesting to hear Mary to explicitly asking people to not rush the pitch if we're lucky enough to win. You might say, well, sure, there's a game happening. There's a big difference between a game happening and then hundreds of people descending onto the pitch. It could set it back weeks, if not months. And also, too, you know, we are bigger than others and we can have lovely rivalry and hope we kick their bums but still be respectful to the opposition. I'm not saying that, but I heard Mary specifically sort of reference that. So that's obviously something important. We want them to go away with the tails between their legs, but happy and respected, if that makes sense. Rightio, that's where we have to leave it on the show today. Just to let you know that our latest podcast is released shortly for you to listen whenever you want to, by the way. We're back live on Monday morning at 9. For me, Caroline and Shannon, have a fantastic weekend and we look forward to already chatting to you next week.